takes to the road to tell the story of the UK in 2021.
This is sort of my third or fourth visit maybe to Milton Keynes.
Oh, are you liking it now?
Meeting people in Perth, Stoke-on-Trent, Swansea and Milton Keynes.
It's our responsibility to create a world we want to live in, almost.
I've never worked this hard in my life.
Do you feel as optimistic now as you did then?
Yes.
Lives beyond the centres of power.
In Wales, people used to say my father was a coal miner, and I'm a coal miner, and now they say my father worked in a call centre, and so do I.
Citizens of Somewhere, starting this Thursday morning at 9 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And now on Radio 4, it's time to join David Mitchell and the panel.
We present The Unbelievable Truth, the panel game built on truth and lies. In the chair, please welcome David Mitchell.
Hello and welcome to The Unbelievable Truth, the panel show about incredible truths and barely credible lies. I'm David Mitchell. It's a show packed with lies and deception, based on an original BBC format devised by Martin Bashir. Please welcome Richard Osman, Zoe Lyons, Holly Walsh and Henning Vane. The rules are as follows. Each panellist will present a short lecture that should be entirely false, save for five hidden truths, which their opponent should try to identify. Points are scored by truths that go unnoticed, while other panellists can win points if they spot a truth, or lose points if they mistake a lie for a truth. First up is Holly Walsh. Holly, your subject is insects, small air-breathing arthropods with six legs and typically one or two pairs of wings. Off you go, Holly. Fingers on buzzers, the rest of you.
Everyone loves insects. Literally everyone. Name a person and I'll tell you how much they love insects. What's that? Queen Victoria? She was so obsessed with insects that she even commissioned the Master of the Queen's Music to write a concerto in honour of the insects in the Buckingham Palace garden, which was a waste of time, as most insects are deaf, and the ones that aren't are much more into dubstep.
Richard.
Are most insects deaf?
They are. Well done. Yes. Of the 30 major insect orders, only 9 contain species that are capable of hearing. Of the 350,000 species of beetle, almost all are deaf.
Another name, Olympian Greg Rutherford. In the 2012 Olympic Village, his nickname was the cockroach, mainly because he survived 2 nuclear explosions and scurries under the bed when you turn the lights on.
Henning.
That Greg Rutherford fact is a fact.
That's not true.
Oh.
His nickname is the Ginger Wizard, which is it's
nice. Amazing to be called that when there's already Ron Weasley.
But it'd be difficult for it to be a nickname if what you are is a ginger wizard.
Oh, we
call that,
so.
What do you call that ginger wizard? We call him the Ginger Wizard.
How about Holly Walsh? Well, put it this way, I never leave home without at least 40 head lice and my pet millipede that I've named David Mitchell after my favourite author. You can use a type of cricket to calculate the temperature and sometimes the weather. For example, entomologists have noticed that if it's going to rain, the cricket is called off.
Henning.
Yeah, I'm sure you can tell from certain crickets what the weather will be like.
If they're going to wear their Wellingtons, it's going to rain. Yeah.
I think you get the point. Yes, you can calculate the temperature using a type of cricket, a snowy tree cricket, commonly referred to as a temperature cricket. You count the number of chirps in 14 seconds, then add 40 to get the temperature.
Jeez.
The praying mantis is the only creature on Earth with just one ear. It used to have 2, but it lost a fight to Mike Tyson.
Zoe.
The praying mantis.
Well,
they're evil, aren't they, praying mantises? They're just weird-looking things, so I imagine maybe it only has, like, one giant ear.
You're absolutely right. The praying mantis has... It has one ear located deep in the centre of its thorax. It's the only animal known to have just one ear.
The name for someone who studies insects is Brian. Over the last 50 years, insect footsteps have got quieter, while their mating sounds have got louder and much, much sexier, or is it just me?
Henning.
With the amount of ambient noise in the world, I can imagine that animals are being louder.
The mating sounds of insects have got louder?
Yes.
That's not true.
Oh.
They haven't. Zoe.
I've got to go for the other bit, but the footsteps have got quieter.
That's the one that's true, yes. According to Bernie Krauser, an expert in bioacoustics who's been recording the natural world since 1968, human interference is muffling nature's voices, from bird songs to wolf howls to insect footsteps. And he says many of an ecosystem's sounds have ceased playing forever.
Yeah, but he's getting older, Bernie. So.
Yes, is he failing to factor in his own deafness?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he also, yeah. Also, I can't hear what they're saying on television. Is anyone noticing?
Yes, why won't they teach actors diction anymore?
Everyone thinks spiders are insects, but they're technically a herb. And everyone thinks bugs are insects, but if you think that, you'd be wrong and an idiot. Basically, most insects are awesome, but bugs suck. They're the worst.
Henning?
Are bugs not classified as insects?
They are classified as insects.
Yeah, I would have thought so.
They're not.
Yeah. Just checking. Right.
Well, it was very good of you to sacrifice the point to check that.
And that's everything you need to know about insects. You may now stop scratching yourselves.
Thank you, Holly. And at the end of that round, Holly, you've managed to smuggle one truth past the rest of the panel, which is that true bugs do suck. The word bug is not simply a North American colloquial term for an insect or invertebrate. It actually has a real scientific definition. In fact, the word bug refers to insects in one particular order, Hemiptera, or true bugs, which have specialised mouth parts like straws that enable them to tap into a food source and suck up fluids. So whilst all bugs are insects, not all insects are bugs, and all bugs suck. And that means you've scored 1 point. OK, we turn now to Henning Vane. Henning is the self-proclaimed German comedy ambassador to Great Britain. And thanks to his tireless efforts over 17 years, he's managed to raise British interest in German comedy to almost negligible. Henning, your subject is words, single units of language that have meaning and can be spoken or written. Off you go, Henning.
In the beginning was the word, which means that words were invented by Jesus. Before Jesus, there was only sign language and smells. In most places, people wrote using pictures, which were worth 1,000 words, unless it was an IKEA Billy bookcase flat pack instruction, in which case words were definitely more concise. The irony was that before words, nobody actually needed an IKEA Billy bookcase. In fact, the Romans never bothered with bookcases because they never had any interesting books. That was because Latin does not contain the word interesting. So as a result, everything to the Romans was either sexy or boring. Today, all Romans live in Italy. Words had a very slow start in Italy, however. And today, most of them still talk with their hands or by leaving objects in your bed. The Mafia are especially keen on keeping quiet. And the word Mafia was never used in the Godfather movie.
Holly.
True.
That is true. Yes, the producer of The Godfather, Al Ruddy, removed all mentions of the words Mafia and Cosa Nostra from the screenplay of The Godfather, despite the constant repetition of these words in the original novel. Ruddy was pressured to remove the words by the Italian-American Civil Rights League, a pressure group set up by Joseph Colombo, the head of a minor New York crime family, to improve the image of mobsters and deny the existence of the Mafia. So, there you go.
Improve our image or lose both your legs.
Yeah. Henny.
English has no word for Bruchbude, meaning substandard accommodation, simply because this is summed up by 99% of UK accommodation. The French, astonishingly, have no word for shrug. When the chairman of the Académie Française, Jean-Jacques Beaumont, was asked why he replied in writing, "I'm lifting my shoulders in a dismissive manner." Today, the English language has more than 2 million words, with 4,000 being added to the Oxford English Dictionary last year. These included geezer bird, rofflecopter, Me3, and decivilization.
Richard.
Rofflecopter.
No, not at all.
I reckon Me3.
No.
Oh, lucky you didn't buzz.
Oh, yeah.
Good point.
I just should have requested a buzz. Schoolboy error. Richard.
Geezer bird.
No.
Fair enough.
Well, this leaves us with just decivilization.
Yeah, go on.
Not true either. Yeah. No. Decivilization.
Well, if this example isn't included in this programme, it's because of the decivilization of the BBC. Words are now more important than ever, because most of them are not allowed. So now that you can't say anything anymore, everything has gone full circle and we're back to pointing and making noises like English people on holiday. As well as banning a lot of words in English, the Scots have no word for yes or no in their original Gaelic language. This means that they had to learn English before they could even have a referendum on independence.
Zoe.
Well, the Gaelic language does... Well, no, it does seem a bit... That is quite basic, isn't it? Yes or no? I've buzzed, I'm going for it. There's no yes or no in Scottish Gaelic.
You're absolutely right.
When the Russian confectionery industry launched a groundbreaking new chocolate bar, they named it Novichok. Unfortunately, some crossed wires at the branding and trade name secretariat resulted in the death of several sweet shop owners.
Thank you, Henning. And at the end of that round, Henning, you've managed to smuggle three truths past the rest of the panel, which are that Latin does not contain a word for interesting. The second truth is that the French have no word for shrug. And the third truth is that English has no word for Bruchbude, meaning substandard accommodation. The closest word in English would probably be hovel. And that means, Henning, you've scored 3 points. Next up is Zoe Lyons. Zoe recently became the host of the quiz show Lightning on BBC Two. The aim of the game is to stay out of the spotlight. Well, hosting a quiz show on daytime television should achieve that. Zoe, your subject is parties, social gatherings held for pleasure, often as a celebration. Off you go, Zoe.
The well-known line, "There is a party in my pants and you're all invited," originates from a centuries-old tradition. A party was thrown to celebrate a boy getting his first pair of trousers.
Holly.
A boy getting his long trousers.
Correct.
Yes.
Well done. Yes, so you're right. There were parties for boys getting their first pair of trousers. They were known as breeching parties and were common in Britain from the 16th to the early 20th centuries among better-off families. For the first few years of their lives, boys and girls were dressed alike. Then, typically between the ages of 4 and 7, boys were breeched or put into breeches, trousers or pantaloons, while girls continued to wear dresses. In Regency times, the newly trousered boy would generally receive his first short haircut, after which his shorn locks were gathered up and given to the party guests as mementos.
Shorn lock?
Do you think maybe he was named after that practice?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, nothing but a going-home present from an 18th-century party.
Either Sean Locks and Jimmy Carrs were handed out at the end of the evening.
In ancient Rome, toga parties were called come-dressed-as-you-are parties. Never one to be perturbed by a party dress code on an invitation. When attending an event at New York Studio 54, Grace Jones once arrived on the back of a camel wearing 2 stuffed puffins as earmuffs. When asked why she was wearing them, she said, "What?" A party punch bowl is so called because a fight will break out amongst partygoers the moment it is drained. One British admiral avoided the social skirmish by using a punch bowl so large it had to be manned by bartenders paddling around inside it in canoes.
Richard.
Canoes in a punch bowl.
Correct.
That's so awesome.
Yes, in 1694, Royal Navy Admiral Edward Russell hosted a week-long party in Alicante for 6,000 sailors, for which he turned a local fountain into a giant punch bowl. It was manned by bartenders who paddled around in a small wooden canoe, filling up the guests' cups and working in 15-minute shifts to avoid passing out from the fumes.
Wow. That was essentially the first series of Love Island.
Andy Warhol employed security at his warehouse parties to frisk people as they left. It followed an incident where an audacious gatecrasher at a plastic people gathering tripped and a can of stolen Campbell's soup dropped out from their skirt.
Holly.
I bet people did nick stuff, so I bet he did have people frisking them on the way out.
No, he didn't.
That's a good lie, though.
That is a really good lie. Yeah. I think she should get an extra point for that quality.
I think that if the points are given out like that, they will lose all value. And it'll be like, this is just a pointless way of wasting
half. I'll value it.
And that's the last thing I want, so I'm afraid I can't allow that.
David Mitchell's a party pooper.
I am a party
pooper. That is true.
Guests attending King Edward VII's weekend house parties, on the other hand, were weighed on arrival and departure to make sure his generous hospitality had caused them to put on weight.
Henny.
I buy that.
You're right to buy that. That's absolutely right. Yes, to ensure they'd been fully indulged during weekend house parties at Sandringham, Edward VII subjected all his guests to being weighed on arrival and departure using a pair of scales. It's rumoured the royal family continue this tradition today, with each member weighing themselves before and after Christmas dinner.
Before and after an interview with Emily Maitlis, I think.
Modes of transport that are available for party hire include Boadicea's war chariot, John Paul II's Popemobile, a boat pulled by harnessed black swans, and a stretch Hummer limousine owned and driven by 1980s rapping legend MC Hammer.
Richard.
MC Hammer's Hummer.
As far as we know, it isn't, I'm afraid. Maybe no longer roadworthy.
That has ruined my weekend.
Yeah. Henning.
The Pope.
John Paul II's Popemobile.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right. That is available.
Well, you can hire the Popemobile to turn up to a party.
Yep. This is the Popemobile used by John Paul II on his visit to Ireland in 1979, and it can be hired for stag and hen parties. The 15-seater vehicle can be hired from the Dublin Wax Museum for a cost of €300 an hour plus VAT. So wow.
That's Vatican.
Joan Collins has a fear of birthday parties. It followed an incident where she passed out while attempting to blow out all the candles on her cake. Bear Grylls is frightened of cocktail parties after he was asked to leave a drinks party because he started a fire by rubbing two martini sticks together. He was later caught at the same event in the kitchen drinking his own wee after straining it through a sock. Annually, more people are killed by pop champagne corks at birthday parties than sharks, but then sharks are very rarely invited to birthday parties.
Richard.
Yeah, I think champagne corks kill more people than sharks.
There are no figures that we could find, but you don't lose a point, okay, but you don't gain a point. We might do a rescoring when the full evidence of the champagne cork deaths comes in.
Have you ever thought about doing sort of follow-up shows? Just, you know, where are they now, those facts? Yeah. And we go back to see...
Well, yes. In fact, there was a show a few years ago where John Finnemore jokingly said that Boris Johnson would become Prime Minister. Uh-huh. It's not such a funny listen now. Anyway, that's the end of Zoe's lecture. And at the end of that round, Zoe, you've managed to smuggle one truth past the panel, which is that Bear Grylls is frightened of cocktail parties. Speaking at a conference in 2017, he said, "We all have fears. I'm scared of cocktail parties with lots of people I don't know. I really genuinely am."
I would honestly, I'd go swimming with sharks before I was anywhere near those champagne bottles. It's just...
Well, they make me very nervous when somebody's taken the wire guard off the champagne and then just continues chatting and waves the thing around. It's like, you know, at school trying to concentrate on a lesson when there's a wasp in the room. You know, just let's get rid of the wasp and then go back to fractions. Sorry, I'm having a flashback. Anyway, that means, Zoe, you've scored 1 point. It's now the turn of Richard Osman. Richard's book, The Thursday Murder Club, is one of the highest-selling hardback novels ever. Take it from me, it's non-stop action from the start of page one to however far you get. Your subject, Richard, is supermarkets, large self-service shops selling foods and household goods. Off you go, Richard.
The first supermarket was opened in Willy Wally, was called Piggly Wiggly's, and only sold Curly Whirlies.
Holly.
Willy Wally.
No, there's no such place.
Supermarkets have been the cause of countless wars over the century. The Peruvian Marmite conflict of 1967 was absolutely horrific, or absolutely delicious, depending on which historian you listen to.
Zoe.
Supermarkets have been the centre of wars over the years. Price wars.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
Yes, but that's yes. not...
Yes.
The thing
yes.
about... yes, well...
Yes, indeedy.
The reason I'm not going to give you a point is because a price war isn't a war.
It's...
In the phrase price war, the word war is used metaphorically.
Well,
it's not
that
a real
depends.
War.
I mean, I'll kill for a bargain.
Again, you're using, I very much hope, the verb kill metaphorically.
No, I mean, I'll
even
really
if
go
you,
for it.
Even if you did kill for a bargain, that wouldn't be a war, it would be a murder.
The 1950s saw the margarine wars in Japan. This was fought between one side who couldn't believe it was not butter and another side who couldn't believe it wasn't not butter. The margarine war spread very quickly until somebody decided to put them in the fridge. Further breakfast skirmishes followed, including the marmalade uprising in Armenia, the coffee battles in Fiji, and the Nutella riots, which took place in France.
Zoe.
Coffee battles, Fiji.
No.
Oh, gosh.
But there were the jam wars in Armenia. I remember that clearly.
The marmalade uprising in Armenia. that's not true.
Oh.
Yeah. Holly.
I reckon the margarine wars might have been a real thing.
No, that's not true. No.
In 1998, grammar activist Jonathan Elliott was prosecuted for vandalism by Sainsbury's after defacing every sign stating eight items or less, so they read eight items or fewer.
We seem to have a Radio 4 audience. Holly.
Yes, bruv.
No, that didn't happen. There's no such grammar activist.
Things went from bad to worse for grammar activist Mr. Elliott when the judge gave him a sentence which ended in a preposition. Peter Foster of Banbury was arrested at his local M&S for resting his testicles on a self-service checkout machine. He was...
Zoe.
This is no ordinary self-checkout machine.
I reckon if I had testicles, I'd pop them out in M&S.
Just gently weigh them. How many? Two of those, hopefully.
Let's see how much they'd cost if they were sprouts.
Yeah.
Well, I'm afraid it's not true about Peter Foster.
He was caught when the machine said, very unexpected item in bag. While Iceland has no stores in Iceland, it once tried to stop the country Iceland from using the name Iceland in an advert.
Holly.
Yes, that last one.
That's absolutely right. In 2014, the UK-based supermarket Iceland secured a trademark for the word Iceland, which began a five-year dispute with the nation of Iceland. In 2019, after the supermarket tried to block the country from using the slogan "Inspired by Iceland" in a tourism advert, the Icelandic government took action and the Intellectual Property Office invalidated the supermarket's trademark in Europe.
The chief executive of Tesco is actually called Deborah Morrison. I'm kidding, she's actually called Elaine Waitrose.
Zoe.
Going for the Morrison.
Chief executive of Tesco, Deborah Morrison?
Yeah.
Not true.
Okay.
Yeah. More likely than Elaine Waitrose, though, you were right. Not Wait. Saying that's not true, Henning, if you want to buzz.
No, I'm not. There could be a double bluff. Oh. Yeah.
Henning, you buzzing
Elaine
for that?
Elaine Waitrose, it is.
No, that's not true.
Waitrose has a unique place in British culture. The first ever winning lottery ticket in the UK was bought at the Waitrose in Winchester, and the £2.1 million jackpot was spent on two bottles of sparkling water and some falafels.
Henning.
First ever winning lottery ticket at Waitrose.
No, that's not true. Certainly not Waitrose in Winchester. The first national lottery win of £5,874,778 happened in 1994, and Winchester didn't get a Waitrose till 2009.
That is insanity.
That is the weirdest Winchester. Fact I've ever learnt on this show.
Do you know what? In the Thursday Murder Club, there's a Waitrose in Tunbridge Wells. And apparently there isn't one.
I heard
people at Tunbridge Wells are fuming.
I heard that the people in Tunbridge Wells were already fuming about the absence of a Waitrose. And I think it was there. There was certainly a place where they didn't have a Waitrose and they felt they ought to have one. And they tried to sue Waitrose for not opening one. As if they, you know, because of the way that was affecting their house prices and general self-esteem. And Waitrose had to explain, we don't have to open one.
Well, I've been caught at the tail end of that comment, let me tell you.
That's throwing salt in that wound.
Isn't it just?
You know what, though? There's a Marks and Spencer's.
In Tunbridge Wells.
Tunbridge Wells, attached to the petrol station as you drive
that's
in.
That's not the same. An M&S food in a petrol station. Oh, that's scant comfort. They want a proper Waitrose with a fish counter.
That is adding insult to injury. Yeah. That is awful. Waitrose has laid on opera recitals, yoga classes, wild water swimming evenings and bingo for its customers. Just time to let you know that Asda sells a pack of 13 chicken nuggets called Unlucky Cluckers, and Asda milk bottles have contain milk written on them.
Holly.
Contain milk.
Asda milk bottles, yes, they have contains milk written on them. In 2009, the same year that Winchester finally got a Waitrose, Asda added contains milk under the allergy advice heading on their milk bottle labels. And that's the end of Richard's lecture. At the end of that round, Richard, you've managed to smuggle three truths past the rest of the panel, which are that the first supermarket was called Piggly Wiggly. Today, there are more than 530 Piggly Wigglies across 17 US states. The second truth is that in January 2018, Nutella riots took place in France. This followed the French supermarket Intermarché offering a 70% discount on Nutella. Kilo jars were going for just €1.40. Customers started fighting and pushing one another to get hold of them. They were going for each other like animals. A woman had her hair pulled, an elderly lady took a box on her head, another had a bloody hand. It was horrible, said one customer. And the third truth is that Waitrose has laid on yoga classes. In 2018, same year as the Nutella riots, 9 years after Winchester got a Waitrose. In 2018, Waitrose trialled a programme of evening yoga classes in their Newbury, Basingstoke and Banbury stores in an attempt to bring in new customers, although not of the kind who might put his sack in the bagging area. And that means, Richard, you've scored 3 points. In 2015, Asda had two of the oldest supermarket workers in the UK, both 90 years old. They later left to join B&Q, where they're known as the youngsters. Which brings us to the final scores. In fourth place, with minus 5 points, we have Henning Vane. In joint second place, with a total of no points between them, it's Holly Walsh and Zoe Lyons. And in first place, with an unassailable 1 point, it's this week's winner, Richard Osman. That's about it for this week. Goodbye.
The Unbelievable Truth was devised by John Naismith and Graham Garden and featured David Mitchell in the chair with panellists Holly Walsh, Richard Osman, Zoe Lyons and Henning Vane. The chairman's script was written by Dan Gaster and Colin Swash.